Have you ever had a really super duper duper long day? Have you ever experienced a long day? Has that ever happened in your life? It's so funny because I don't like it when God gives me examples to give to you right away, especially when it's bad stuff like this with long days. So as most of you know, Heather and I were in Florida as we were celebrating the wedding of Lauren Cruz to Shane Welter, and we got there. It was great. We were thankful for all that happened. We had a great wedding, great rehearsal, great wedding. It was hotter than blazes. I was wearing a black suit, and the sun was to my back, and we were outdoors. The sermon was really short, so that's how you can shorten my sermons, is if we just heat me up a little bit more. But after the wedding was over, it was great because we'd been watching the weather reports all along, and Wednesday was the rehearsal, and Thursday was the wedding, which is a strange time to do a wedding. But I'm really glad they got married on a Thursday, because on Friday, Claudette decided to show up, and this was it was just going to be a storm, but as it started moving through the Gulf of Mexico, it got a little bit bigger and a little bit stronger, and so, we go out to eat on Friday night. The storm is starting to move in. It's actually pretty hilarious, but we get back, and that night, Friday night, we go to bed, and that's when, for us, one of the longest days started happening. So Saturday morning, early in the morning, I wake up because our hotel, we're on the sixth floor, our hotel was going back and forth shaking because of the winds, 81 mile an hour winds. So we're like, I hope we're not going to die today. That would be really bad. And so we wake up, and the storm is just massive, and it's pouring outside, and we're watching the Weather Channel, and the Weather Channel is actually broadcasting at the hotel right next to us. We actually even took pictures like, wow, the Weather Channel is out here in Pensacola, Florida. This is crazy. And the storm is just, it's massive. And we're sitting there wondering, do airplanes fly in storms? I don't think they do, because when we were in Minneapolis, we got caught in a storm with the youth group, and like, they wouldn't let us fly, but we're like, we're going to see if we can get there. So we check out of our hotel, and thankfully, we'd been checking Uber all morning long, like, please, is there any crazy people still driving Uber this morning? And sure enough, one shows up, we click it, the guy was great, he's like, this is tree trimming weather, what are you talking about? It's just clearing out all the dead branches for us. Well, okay, great. And we had heard that morning, because there are three bridges that we had to cross to get, now, I'm not used to these types of bridges. These bridges are close to the water. Like, why don't they just build them up a little higher? Like, why do you have to be right on the water? And sure enough, a semi-truck had blown over and was blocking. I'm like, are we even going to make it to the airport? It had gotten cleared. We're going over 3-mile bridge, because guess how long it is? 3 miles. Again, can't they just raise them up a little bit? Like, why do they have to be right on the water? And we get there, and we get into the airport, and the airport is packed, because everyone was coming to the airport, but no one was leaving on the airplanes. So we are sitting there hoping and praying we can get out. We finally get the plane in front of us. Finally, Heather's checking the radar all the time and wondering, and she's like, oh, there's a break coming up. Like the storm has moved in, but as these bands and tails are swirling around, she's like, we got a break. Sure enough, there's a slight break. The pouring down rain stops, and it's like, oh, I think we're gonna, and all of a sudden, planes are flying, you know, there's all these gates are starting to get filled, and there's now more people pouring into the airport, and finally we get some people out, and then finally our flight, and a band is coming, and Heather's like, there's a band coming in right now, and I don't know, and so they're like, ladies and gentlemen, get on the plane, quick, come on, let's go, and we get on, and we start going, and you can start seeing the rain is starting to pour down a little bit more, and we are pulling away from the gate. This is no joke, and the pilot says, we have been cleared for takeoff. I'm like, but we're not even near the runway yet. So all of us, yeah, that's what he's doing. He starts going, and he's going fast. I'm like, I know you have to kind of like make a turn, like to get like on. And we take this turn pretty fast, in my opinion. And as we're making the turn, all of a sudden you hear this. And I'm like, we haven't made the turn yet, dude. But we're like, and like we hit the thing and we are already taking. I'm like, okay, hold on, everybody. And sure enough, I mean, it is bouncy, it is chopped, but we made it out. Woo! All right. But we're now like 30 minutes delayed, which wasn't too bad, but our layover in, no, we were longer than that, 40 minutes delayed, but our layover in Houston was 50 minutes. So we're flying, and you could feel this dude's making up time. We're burning jet fuel all over the place. And you know how when the plane starts to descend, usually, like, you can hear the engines kind of throttle back a little bit because, you know, they're starting the descent. There's no throttling back. All of a sudden, it's like, we're starting to point downwards, but it's still full throttle. And we're coming in hot to Houston. And as we get there, I'm like, we are going really fast for this. And thankfully, I think Houston's a bigger airport because we hit that thing and we hit it hard. And then we got it. And right, we get to the gate agent pops on board. Yes, if you're the Long Beach connectors, which is us, you got 10 minutes to get to gate 49. So we quickly look because we landed at gate 25 or something like that. Yeah, we're nowhere near it. Oh, this is fantastic. So we are we're racing through the airport. I actually started running. Yeah, Heather's got a scooter, so she's like full power. She's like, she's racing through. We get there. Oh, you've got to get a new tag for the scooter. Like, we got to get a new tag for the scooter. Just put it in the plane. And they're like, oh, you've got time. Your bags aren't even here yet. I'm like, what? So and finally, everything, we sit down and we take off and then we land in Long Beach. And what a beautiful thing when you open up the doors of the airplane and there's no humidity. Oh, man. What a beautiful thing that is. And then we, you know, drive home and we're exhausted. Yesterday for us was a super duper duper long. Now I could probably say there's other times in my life that I've had longer days, but yesterday was definitely a really long day. Joshua chapter 10 has, I believe, because I don't know of any other record of it, but I do believe it has the longest day on record. Now, I think it's also fun because what day is today? Summer solstice. This is the longest day. Like, we've got the most hours of daylight is today, and we get to talk about Joshua chapter 10, which has the longest day recorded in humankind. So you're there at Joshua 10. Let me get us back into what we were supposed to be. Remember last week, it was the Gibeonite deception. These people came, they lied, they, you know, do we keep the treaty even though they lied to get us into this treaty? And God is big on covenants. But again, there's some options that are for the Israelites because they've gone and they've taken out this place, but they still have a problem because there is still a massive army amassing, not just from one town, but from like 5, 6, 7 towns have gathered all their army and they're getting ready to attack the Israelites. Now, the Israelites have faced a lot of problems. They had the crossing of the Jordan. They had the battle at Jericho, which really wasn't that much of a battle. They took out the people in Gibeon. They took out the people in Ai. So they have some battle experience, but this is from kind of smaller things. And now they're about to go into a big, huge, gigantic battle. Chapter 10, verse 1. Now, Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, which is kind of crazy that this king of Jerusalem, eventually he's going to lose that land because that's where the Jewish people are going to put up their headquarters. When they had heard that Joshua had taken Ai and totally destroyed it, doing to Ai and its king as he had done to Jericho and its king, and that the people of Gibeon had made a treaty of peace with Israel and were living near them, he and his people were very much alarmed at this because Gibeon was an important city, like one of the royal cities. It was larger than I, and all its men were good fighters. So this is a problem, because what did the men of Gibeon just do with the Israelite nation? They just went into a treaty with them. So now they're like, we're really ticked off, and we're angry that Gibeon essentially turned and became part of the Israelite nation. Verse 3, so Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, appealed to Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon, and said, come up and help me attack Gibeon, he said, because it has made peace with Joshua and the Israelites. So we've got these five kings, they've banded together, the five kings of the Amorites, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon, joined forces. They moved up with all their troops and took up positions against Gibeon and attacked it. And so the Gibeonites sent word to Joshua in the camp of Gilgal, do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Help us, because all the Amorite kings from the hill country have joined forces against us. Now this is a wonderful opportunity for the Israelite nation to get out of the treaty. The treaty that they had made with the Israelites was, don't attack us. Don't kill us, because we've heard your God is pretty amazing. And even though they did it through trickery, the Israelites now, what do you do? Do we keep the covenant with the people of Gibeon, even though we're not going to invalidate it by letting the five kings attack? So they could say, you know what? We're going to let the five kings attack. We didn't attack you. They did. We won't defend you, and because we won't defend you, you will all die, and now we're out of the treaty. We're pretty good at loopholes, aren't we? Aren't we always trying to find loopholes in things? We're always trying to find out, okay, I got stuck in this. How do I get out of this without invalidating what God wants? How do I still kind of follow it, but not really? This happens every time, literally every time I get on the freeway. I know that sign says 65, but let's be honest, who drives 65? Like, Josh does, you are correct. Joshua, you are a good rule follower, and I'm so proud of you, and keep driving that speed limit. He's too afraid to drive fast, which makes me super happy. But we always, what is our reasoning behind not following that rule? Everybody else is driving that fast. I throw in even more. If I drive 65, I'm becoming a hazard to the rest of the... Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. So I can justify me breaking the law because of all of the other things around us. We do this all the time with lots of treaties, with lots of agreements. You decide to make an agreement with your group of people who are doing a group project, that you will do certain things, and then as the time comes, you find out you had homework from another class, you had soccer practice that evening, and you hadn't seen your girlfriend in a while, so maybe I cannot follow this because I've got lots of other good reasons and good excuses, and I will find a way to get out of this treaty. Now, the Israelites decide to keep the treaty. They decide to say, we are not going to abandon you at your time of need. Instead, we will actually come and help. So verse 7, Joshua marched up from Gilgal with his entire army, including all the best fighting men. The Lord said to Joshua, you shouldn't have been in a treaty with those stupid people in the first place. Do not be afraid of them. I have given them into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you. So here again, God had said, destroy the Gibeonites. They instead get into a treaty with them, and God says, now you're going to march. And so some people are like, is God happy with this treaty? We really don't know the answer to that question, but we do know this. God specifically then tells them, as they're getting ready to march up, he says, do it. I'm with you. I will back you. My power will be with you. That's pretty impressive. I have a sneaking suspicion that if the Israelite nation had gone and sought the Lord about the Gibeonites, I wouldn't be surprised if God would have said, yes, keep them, they want to be with you. And why do I say that? Because there was also another town that was supposed to be 100% destroyed. Every person in that town was supposed to die, and that was the town of Jericho. But God honors the covenant that was made with the spies, with the girl Rahab, and not just Rahab, but her entire family. God gives us these huge principles, but there's always room for God's grace. And I think we forget that. There's always room for God's grace. So God here is saying, you made this covenant with them, and I want you to honor that covenant. And you're not going to abandon these people at their greatest hour of need. That's the room of God's grace, and that's our model. That is our example, that we don't run or abandon at the greatest time of someone's life. So, verse 9, after an all-night march from Gilgal, we don't really understand some of the details. I have never done an all-night march. Now, I know military people have talked about how painful those things are. Could you imagine you are going all night long just to get to a location, and when you get there, you are going to fight? After an all-night march from Gilgal, Joshua took them by surprise. The Lord threw them into confusion before Israel, who defeated them in a great victory at Gibeon. Israel pursued them along the road, going up to Beth Horon, and cut them down all the way to Azekah and Makkedah. As they fled before Israel on the road down from Beth Horon to Azekah, the Lord hurled large hailstones down on them from the sky, and more of them died from the hailstones than were killed by the swords of the Israelites. Now, would you be a little bit terrified if you were the opposing army at this point? You're fighting, and all of a sudden, a massive hail. And if I remember correctly, not anyone from Israel, like, you're fighting and a hailstone hits, and like, you're about to take a swing, and wham, this dude's gone. And then here's a huge battalion over here, and hailstone, and all of these people are being crushed by God. It's God saying, I'm going to fight for you. Not only am I going to fight with you, but I'm going to fight for you. We sing some songs like this, right? You know, who could stop the Lord Almighty? We have battle motifs all throughout Scripture. Now, I'm going to touch on this in just a little bit, because are some of you feeling a little uncomfortable with this? Is anyone here uncomfortable with God hurling massive hailstones and crushing the enemy? This is one of those, as we get into it, as I spoke last week, some of these chapters are going to become a little dark, especially to our Western ears. And I'm going to remind us of a few things in just a moment. But this is, I think, an important lesson, that God helps us in many ways. Sometimes he's going to give us the strength and the ability to do things that we would otherwise not be able to do. Sometimes he's going to take care of the enemy before the enemy even shows up. Sometimes he's going to actually allow the enemy to win a little bit in order to get them more prideful so that God can take them out in their pride. God uses many and various ways to help out his people, which is why we should never become formulaic in how God operates in our lives. How God helps you will be different than how he helps you or you or you or you. God uses many various ways, and here it's with large hailstones. Verse 12, on the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, O sun, stand still over Gibeon, O moon, over the valley of Ajalon. And there's a record of this event in what's called the Book of Jashar. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped till the nation avenged itself on its enemies, as it is written in the Book of Jashar. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down about a full day. Longest day in history. Now, you're wondering, how does this happen? So is it, because all the scientific people are like, what are the mechanics of this? Because did the sun stop or did the earth stop? As we know, the sun is actually not moving across, the earth is rotating. And I remember reading reports that said, if God stopped the earth from rotating, people, yes, would have just been, we would be flung. Like if he stopped it right now, we would go out into space because we all stopped. So did he do that? Did he cause the sun to reverse its orbit so that it stayed in the earth's still rotating, but the sun is, what's the answer? I have absolutely no idea how God does these things. I wondered this when he stopped the Jordan River. Remember that? How did he stop a river from coming downstream? And some people are like, well, you know, at certain times there's earthquakes, and so sometimes it reverses course. And you try to come up with all these natural explanations. The problem is, it wasn't that the river just like stopped and then reversed. The water stopped up on a heap back a couple miles. How did that happen? Now, was that because then the water from upstream stopped flowing? Did it go over, like, how did it with this dip? We have no idea. That is not in the Book of Jashar, but it's one of these things with God. We're always looking for natural explanations. And I think that's the reason why God and the miracles sometimes don't seem that amazing, is because we always have a reason for it happening. I have no idea how the sun could stand still. I have no idea how God could create everything in 6 days. I have no idea why it took God 6 days to create. He could have done it in 6 milliseconds. I don't know how a dead person who has been in the grave for many a days all of a sudden has its life revitalized and can come out of a tomb. I don't know how a paralyzed man who has never walked since birth can now stand up on his strong legs. I have no idea. Does that mean it didn't happen? Again, I think one of the greatest examples of this is the microwave. Does anyone know how the microwave actually works? Yeah, some of you probably do. Yeah, George is like, I do, actually. It's something about, like, it shoots waves, small waves, so they're like microwaves. Yeah. And it shoots it through an item which agitates it, which makes it hot. Well, how did the microwaves get into the microwave to begin with? How does it generate it? This is fascinating. It's crazy. I remember my grandmother who lived to see a lot of things in her life. My grandmother would never fly in an airplane. Do you know why she never flew in an airplane? How do you, she's like, that's a giant metal tube, right? It's got to be some voodoo magic to get it to get in the air. And I'm like, well, it's really all about thrust. We're cleared for takeoff. And she also had a problem with MP3 players. My dad would always record my sermons. He would download, he'd put them on MP3 player, and he would give them to my grandma. And my grandma would look at it, and she'd go, how does it fit in there? She's like, where's the tape? Like, is it wound? I'm like, no, it's flash memory, grandma. Well, what's flash memory? I don't know. It's voodoo magic, grandma. I don't know how it works. I have no problem with God doing things miraculous. Do you want to know what I think is the most miraculous about this particular event? It was that God listened to Joshua. Remember, it wasn't God that said, hey, Joshua, you're going to finish the battle, and in finishing the battle, I'm going to just ask for the sun to set to stop, and I'll stop. Who here would have actually asked for the sun to stop? Would any of you done that? You know what I would have done? God, we just need a few more hailstones. We could finish this job really fast. Just like massive hailstones, crush the entire enemy, and we're done. I don't know if, God would be like, that would have been a much easier trick than stopping the sun. I find it amazing that God listens to his people. God actually listens to you. And he doesn't listen to you like, oh, that's really sweet. Thank you, child of mine. You don't know what you're asking. God is always listening to his children. And I find that incredible. To the point where Joshua comes out with the craziest prayer. And God says, I'll do it. I think there's a crazier prayer than this. Lord, I don't deserve your love at all, but will you still save me and forgive me of all the things I've done in the past and all the things I'm going to do in the future? And God will, every time, without fail, say, yes, I will do that. So God gives Joshua this gift. I don't know if I would have really liked it. Who here would like to march all night, then battle all day on a day that lasts 48 hours? But God grants it. And as it says, verse 14, there has never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to a man. God listens to his people. He listens to you and to me. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. Then Joshua returned with all Israel to the camp at Gilgal. All right, so now, if you get squeamish on details, this next section is going to be difficult. Now the five kings had fled and hidden in the cave at Makkedah. I mean, I guess that's what you do if you're a king and you're fighting and the sun is stopped and hailstones are falling from the sky and they only seem to be targeting your people. What would you do? I think maybe I would run. And that's what these five kings do. They run and they hide in a cave at Makkedah. He said, roll large rocks up to the mouth of the cave and post some men there to guard it, but don't stop. Pursue your enemies. Attack them from the rear and don't let them reach our city. For the Lord your God has given them into your hands. So Joshua and the Israelites destroyed them completely, almost to a man. But the few who left reached their fortified cities. The whole army then returned safely to Joshua in the camp at Makkedah. No one uttered a word against the Israelites. Joshua said, open the mouth of the cave and bring these five kings out to me. So they brought the five kings out, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon. When they had brought these kings to Joshua, he summoned all the men of Israel and said to the army commanders who had come with them, come here and put your feet on the necks of these kings. So they came forward and placed their feet on their necks. I don't know the logistics of that. Did they like get their neck stepped on by like everybody? Was there one person who was symbolic? I have no idea. But it's this idea that you have been conquered. Then Joshua said to them, "Do not be afraid, do not be discouraged, be strong and courageous. This is what the Lord will do to all the enemies you are going to fight." Then Joshua struck and killed the kings and hung them on five trees, and they were left hanging on the trees until evening. And at sunset, Joshua gave the order, and they took them down from the trees and threw them into the cave where they had been hiding. At the mouth of the cave, they placed large rocks, which are there to this day. That day Joshua took Makkedah. He put the city and its king to the sword and totally destroyed everyone in it. He left no survivors, as he did to the king of Makkedah, as he had done to the king of Jericho. This next section, I'm not going to read it, but essentially what it says is after killing the kings, they go to each of the cities and they destroy the city. And then they go to the next city, and that's why it says southern cities conquered, these five cities get destroyed. So what do we do with something like this? Because it's hard for us when we think of wars, battles, fighting, death. We have a hard time with this. We even have certain laws, wartime laws in place that say if someone is surrendered or they're unarmed, that you don't kill them. You provide them the protection that they need. And here, they're completely wiped out. And it comes to the point where it sometimes feels like God is just being cruel. And this is where I think it's really helpful to get through the book of Joshua in our Western mindset, is to remember who God is. To think of God and know God in his totality. Now, I think part of the problem is we sometimes whitewash scriptures to the point that God is no longer a warrior. Instead, he's just a kindly old grandpa that, you know, come sit on his lap and ask him to give you candy and he'll give it to you. On Father's Day, it's interesting that we talk about this because I think we've lost a little bit of that battle motif. God is a warrior. And there's a reason why he's a warrior, because God will do whatever it takes to save his children, period. If his children are in trouble, God will take them out. Men, does this sound like something you would do? If someone came against your family, would you do whatever it took? And in fact, I think that we often take it too far where God always has room for grace. God had told Abraham, God had made a covenant with his people saying, you're going to inherit this land and you're going to do it once the sins of the land have been piled up. And so God waits. God waits for years, 10, 20, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. And all this while, the evil is just so horrendous in the land. Things that you would be shocked at are being done to women and to children. It is some of the most disgusting stuff taking place. And God is still got his room for grace. Like, not yet. We need to wait. Why do we need to wait? Because there's still righteousness. How do I know this? Because that's what God does. When they were about to, when God was going to destroy the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, what did Abraham do? Do you remember? Abraham goes to God and says, God, you're going to kill this whole city? But wait, what if there are righteous people in that city? Well, God says, well, I wouldn't. Abraham, what if there's 50? This is a big thing. What if there are 50 people in there who are righteous? And God says, you know what? No. If there are 50 people who are righteous in the city of Sodom, I won't destroy it. And Abraham says, awesome. Hold on, God. 40? 40 people. God says, no, I wouldn't. 30? 20 times. Abraham's negotiating with God, which is usually not a very smart thing to do, but he's trying to find out how many righteous people would be in the land and prevent it from being destroyed. And the inference behind it is God will not destroy those people if there is any hope of salvation, if there is any righteousness left within it. God waited 400 years, delaying his judgment until finally it is so far gone, I've got to put an end to it. And yet even then, what is God doing? He's saving prostitutes and their families. He's saving liars and deceivers who are tricking the Israelites into a treaty, because God always has room for grace. All this time, with every one of these cities, at any point, what could the city have done? The city could have said, yeah, we've messed up. This is not good. God. But what do? They stubbornly say, no, God, we hate you. Our God is more powerful, and we're still going to fight. And every single time, they get wiped out. And God will ultimately, at some point, come with judgment on all of us. And I think some of us are trying to wait too long. I'll get to it later. No, God has already given you all the evidence you need to show that he is real. And if you still want to fight against him, if you still say, God, I hate you and everything you stand for, God is not going to force you into heaven. He'll allow what's going to happen, which is judgment. When I read passages like this and it becomes very difficult, I always have to put this into the context of the graciousness of God, that every time God moves, there's room for grace. This isn't because God hates people. It's because people hate God. So what do? How do we live? This is one of those times when you just have to say, there is going to come a time when you will not be able to come into the grace of God anymore. And that time will happen when you cease to draw breath into your lungs. And you do not want to wait until the end. Now, God does save people at the end, doesn't he? You could be minutes from dying like a thief on a cross and still come to faith. But I encourage you not to take that path. I think the path now is, God, forgive me, help me, I want to follow you. And God always has room for grace. He always has room for you. For these people, they rejected God completely, and it ended poorly for them. For us, we cry out and pray for forgiveness. And then pray some crazy prayers. I think sometimes we're too worried about that. God, can you please help me pass this test? That seems a little selfish, right? And remember, God doesn't answer prayers based out of selfishness, right? Oh, wait. Yeah, he does. God, I just really want to find a parking spot. My wife prays for that all the time. Help us find a park. I'm like, God is running the universe. He does not care about you and your parking spot. And then a parking spot opens up and God's like, Mark, you're an idiot. I'm like, you're right. I am an idiot. Pray some crazy prayers. Joshua prayed for the sun to stand still, and it did. But again, the craziest prayer you could pray is, Lord, forgive me of my sin, and God will forgive you, because he always has room for